Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what the fuckleberry fins? All right, I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. Welcome to the show. Jason Schwartzman is on the show today. I like that guy. Nice guy. Do you remember the first time you saw Jason Schwartzman? Probably in Rushmore, where you were like, who is that guy? Where did that guy come from? He's great. Had a nice conversation with him. So that's happening soon. Hey, you know what I don't do enough? Gratitude. Did I say that? Gratitude. I want to thank all of you people who listen and send me stuff and send me letters and emails and presents and records. I get them. I listen to your records. I listen to them once, maybe twice. And if they stick, I'll say something and I'll enjoy them and I play them more. I do give a listen to the records I get. I will tell you that and I appreciate it. Gratitude. I'm doing okay. Doing better than okay. I should get up in the morning and go like, you know what? It kind of worked out. It didn't look like it was going to, and it is now, so you're going to have to accept that and behave properly. Stop complaining and not having a nice time. How long do you think life goes on for, man? Can't keep chasing shit and comparing yourself to other people. Sometimes I just want to split, man. So last week it was like, I'm fucking done with Twitter. I'm done with all this bullshit. Just goddamn noise. There's just noise everywhere. Draining, demanding noise. And it keeps poking at you. The noise that pokes. That's where we are culturally. Just this racket, this yammering racket that is always kind of pushing its way into you at varying degrees of intensity and volume. How many machines you got to turn off to get some fucking peace of mind? God damn it. Am I getting sick? I got to shoot today. Oh, there's the dog. Sounded like somebody was torturing a monkey up the street just an hour ago. It was crazy. I know what the hell it was. Either someone bought a pet monkey or they were torturing somebody. Then my neighbor Adam said he was washing his parrots. So that explains it. I was in the jungle area. I was in the territory. I got the general tone of the sound correct. I made a mistake between a complaining monkey and an excited parrot being bathed. I'd forgotten that my neighbor had parrots, and I was reminded of that as I woke up in the jungle this morning. Oh my God. Today's the day, man. 12-page day. I don't know if you guys know how TV works. What happened? Here's how we do it. We're shooting about an episode every 3 days, and we kind of go back and forth in those episodes every day and shoot pieces of them. So, you know, an 8-page day is a pretty hearty day, and our first day today of shooting is a 12-page day, and that's going to be a lot. That's like, you're back in, man. And my life right now pretty much looks like what'll happen is, like, I'll get my lines in my head last night. Then I get up and I, you know, I'm on set all day and I'm running lines with my co-stars. We're doing the scenes, you know, as many times as necessary. We just jam at it all day long. Different outfits, different scenes, different actors, different angles. get that coverage. Hopefully we get some good stuff. The two scripts we're doing this week are great. And then I work 12 hours, 13 hours, come back home, shower, wait an hour, get the sides for the next day, start cramming those lines into my head. I'm in every scene, not complaining. It's my show, but that's the way it works. So it's pretty heavy, man. So I'm going to be underwater, for about 2.5 months doing my show and talking to you people. Won't be a lot of stand up, maybe on Saturdays, but this is it. This is season 3. We're in it. I'm excited. And I honestly am overwhelmed by the response to season 2 and even season 1 on Netflix. I'm glad you guys like the show. Okay, look, let's do this. Let's talk to Jason Schwartzman. I never talked to him before. I always assumed he'd be a good guy, but he's a very sweet man. And I was thrilled to meet him. We had a nice time. It was one of those situations where I'm like, you're so familiar with a guy, and then he's like that guy. And that's always, it's comforting. All right, let's enjoy now my guest, Jason Schwartzman. I listened to your first Coconut Records record.
You did?
Yeah.
Oh.
I listened to it yesterday.
Thank you.
It's nice. It's nice pop music.
Thank
you. Very sweet. But I can tell you're a gear guy. Because it sounds like some guy who sat there and did it.
I love SM7.
Yeah, the best.
It's a great mic.
You like them?
Yeah, I really do.
Do you sing in them?
I've never used this mic to sing in before, but you see lots of people that do.
Yeah, I heard Michael Jackson sings in these.
Come on.
Yeah, SM7s, that's what I heard.
Really?
In the studio. I've had everybody on these. Like when I record people playing music in here, and I just, because I don't have anything, I can't mix. All I can do is ride levels. So.
Right.
So it's just going to be a mic'd guitar and that. And I have everybody sing on that. And to hear it with no, to hear singers with no filter, no nothing, this thing does it.
It's
amazing.
The best.
What do you use it for?
I don't have one. I want one.
You do?
Yeah.
Just to have?
Well, I would like to have a mic like this, like that's, this can do anything.
Yeah.
And I feel that there's something indestructible about this.
There
and
is.
I like indestructible things.
Yeah, Shure makes a couple of things like that. The 58 too.
That I have.
You gotta have a few of those.
Yeah, you should have a few.
Yeah, you gotta do a few 58s.
But I love gear, but it's sort of embarrassing because I would say that I spend if there is free time at night, to just sit there, and my favorite thing to do is just look at pictures of.
Gear
and read about gear and what things do.
Yeah.
And then I watch a lot of videos.
You do?
I love them. But then there is a moment, too, where because I'm not so technically minded, there's a moment when it goes, it crosses way beyond what I know.
Yeah.
Which is fine when I'm at home, but definitely it happens like at stores.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, oh, is this keyboard? So, like, all I've heard about keyboards or I've read about keyboards. That, for years, I've been looking for one just to play one and really get your hands on it. And I get there and I'm talking about it. But I guess, I'm enthusiastic about it. But sometimes that can be misunderstood for not deep knowledge about it.
Yeah.
And sometimes the person will be, I'm glad you know about this. It's great. And plus we can double connect the oscillators of the thing. And then I just sort of then I'm too embarrassed to say that I don't know.
You go, Oh,
it's great. Yeah. Can you show me an example of how that happened? So it's a little like that, but I love it. And it, not only that, I love gear and I buy gear. It's my favorite thing to look for and invest in. I mean, I don't have crazy stuff, but
you have a lot of guitars.
It's also the most aesthetically beautiful stuff to me.
Oh yeah,
you know what I mean?
We were talking about that stuff inside.
Yeah,
the eye for design on stuff is pretty amazing.
And most photos, like rock and roll photos.
Yeah,
I typically don't like live looking photos. Like Hendrix on stage.
No.
I get that it's amazing. To me, I much prefer seeing Todd Rundgren sitting at the desk in his studio with his head in his hand not getting it right or something.
Right,
just so you can look around at all this stuff.
Yeah, the amp in the background.
Sure.
What kind of pencils?
I love it. Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Has he got a little stress ball on the...
I love it, yeah. Does he have this hand?
Yeah, that thing, the hand exercise.
Wow, I'm not at this level. What
I don't know.
What
I don't know. Someone sent that to me.
So embarrassing.
It's hard, right?
Yeah, I can't even close it. It's a hard one. But I love it so much, and I do believe in the idea that every instrument you write differently on each thing. Some people think, oh, I don't know if that's true, and it probably isn't for everybody. But I think each guitar or each pedal has a thing about it. Even if it's imperceptible, if you feel that it has something different, I think that it can offer you something.
Well, that's the magic thing. Things do have magic if you invest it in there. You want a coaster or you want to put the...
I'll put it right here.
Okay, we'll see what happens.
This is a reverse coaster.
Yeah, we'll see if it...
I put it on nothing. If it falls, floats over.
If it doesn't end up in your lap, it's all good.
It seems to go... It works perfectly.
All right, well then I've never seen that happen before. This is a first. You stacked your coffee cup on the tape. But yeah, I believe that's true. I think that some instruments have, they whatever they bring out of you, it's what you... There's definitely magic to it. I've talked to people about that before, people believing in magic and believing what... Of course that's going to provoke you. Each thing's going to have its own power. You have a lot of guitars?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
Well, you write the songs, at least on that record, they're all very different, so they all have a different feeling to them. And, I imagine that playing different instruments and getting different groove going with things. There's a little R&B on there. There's a little pop. There's some sad music.
Yeah,
maybe even a country song.
Well, that happened... Basically, what happened was I had been writing music, but the way that I like to do it is in pieces.
Yeah.
I just sort of write little chunks of things.
Yeah.
And then later I assemble them. And anyway, I usually record music with my friend Woody Jackson, who, if you want to see an amazing studio, if you truly are in the LA, if you go deeper into the LA area on Melrose near Larchmont, you should see his studio. It's called Electrobug Studio, and it's unbelievable. I'll show you pictures.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, the oldest recording studio in Los Angeles.
That's his?
Yeah, and his collection of instruments and just musical aesthetics has been inspiring. But anyway, so I usually work with him, but I ended up... I had a bunch of songs.
Yeah.
And but they weren't songs. They were just pieces.
Yeah.
And I had been broken up with...
Is it 17?
No, this was now when I made my Coconut Records record. It was 25 or 4 or something.
And so you've done some acting already.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've been working.
And I was in a band called Phantom Planet that began in 1994.
How old were you?
14.
So was that the first thing that was before acting, really? Was you wanted to be a rock guy?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, without a doubt.
And you were a drummer?
Yeah.
Can you still play drums?
Yeah, I can. I don't. It's such a, at least the kind of drumming that I'm interested in, and it's such a lonely instrument, because I like to play songs like with people.
You like to sing?
I was never a singer. That was never my, I sing on the records because my little brother actually encouraged me to do it.
Yeah.
But initially I'd asked him to sing on my records. He's
Your
a
brother.
Really good singer. Yeah. My brother Robert, he's a real singer. He like warms up and stuff.
Right.
And, but I had never thought about singing. And I also, in my band, I was in a band that had 3 great singers.
Yeah.
So I never had to sing.
Yeah.
But I play drums and, but I don't play them. I have some in my house.
Yeah.
But if you play for 2 seconds, it's lonely. I want to play with people.
Yeah.
I want to play songs.
Well, you got to play drums to a track or something.
Yeah. It's, I mean, unless you're interested in pushing the bounds of rhythm.
Right.
Which... In theory, I am. I mean, I would love to. I mean, I'm not against it, but it's not my go-to way to spend time.
But you were saying before that, like, writing songs or sitting with a guitar, because for me, it's very meditative. Like,
yes.
I can't sit quietly.
Yeah.
So, like, if I play guitar for a half an hour a day, like, it really gets me out of my head.
Sure.
It's the best thing.
For me, basically, the way that it's been for the last few years, ever since I had a kid, I have 2 children, but my first child came about 4 years ago, and the way that I used to make music was more loudly.
Yeah.
I used to write, walk around and hum things,
yeah.
and sing them with an acoustic guitar into a tape recorder and such. Then I couldn't make as much noise in my house, so I started to learn how to use my GarageBand in my computer, and you can use MIDI. Like, I'd plug in my MIDI keyboard and just use the sounds in it. And, if you were to walk by me, you don't really hear anything except probably me humming.
Yeah.
And I got into a process of writing and demoing at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I don't sit and make up music without a recording. I write, I do it, I multi-track, and I do it. Like, that's part of the writing. But really what it is it's the meditative thing of, like, layering things and coming up with a chord progression. And it's, to me, it's the ultimate way to spend time. And yeah. At the end of a day, I try to do it every day at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And
for how long?
3 hours is my minimum.
Really? So you're abandoning your wife and children for 3 hours?
Yeah, well, they are asleep.
Oh,
they abandon me.
So you do it in the middle of the night?
Mm-hmm. That's what I do. And I would do it in the daytime, but I try to do it at night now. And essentially, like, they'll go to bed, and then I'll go out. And I haven't done it in the last few months because we are our second daughter. But usually the thing is that it's like people who go to a gym or whatever. It just feels so good
right.
to think about music. And
also now with technology, what you can do just sitting on your own for 3 hours is pretty phenomenal.
It's really fun. And even if it's terrible.
Yeah. You have it.
It's the best way to spend time. Even if you just are learning how to play someone else's song or covering someone else's song, it feels good to do music. And I think my brain feels... it feels good. Like it's like you say, it's meditative.
Yeah. And will you grow up with music? I mean, there's music in your family.
Yeah. I grew up with music, but not. My mom's really into musicals, so like that. I grew up her picking me up from school, and it was like Into the Woods blasting. Oh, really? She pulls up at carpool. Into the Woods. Oh, guys, I gotta go. Sorry. My mom loves it. But never like was like listening to tons of music as a kid, like in the car with my
wasn't
dad.
Her father.
My dad listened to a lot of talk radio.
Right. Wasn't your grandfather a composer?
Yeah, he was a composer.
Were you around for him? Did you see?
Yeah. Well, sadly, he died when I was about 10 or 9. I forget exactly, but
what was his name?
Carmine.
Yeah.
And
but you remember him?
Oh yeah. The best.
Yeah.
And I am bummed that I wasn't into music on a deeper level then, because I would have loved to have talked to him. But I always felt growing up that music was more, I guess, my alley. I didn't think it would be like a profession, obviously,
sure.
at a young age. But
yeah.
Movies were so, it was like Lethal Weapon.
Right.
Ghostbusters, you know, just big blockbusters,
yeah.
comedies, all
yeah.
the Bill Murray.
Yeah.
And I hear people saying it that when they would watch movies, they would think, I'm going to be up there one day. And I think that's cool. I never had that experience. To me, it was just the excitement of going to see a movie and loving it. And, you know, what everyone probably does, you imitate the movies on the way home and stuff. You do the lines. But that was where it sort of stopped.
You never saw yourself as an actor or
no
wanted
way.
To be a movie star.
And I don't know if it also comes from growing up in L.A.,
well, grow,
where a lot of kids are actors.
Where'd you grow up exactly?
Westwood.
Okay. But like also like, I mean, you know, you grew up in sort of a movie clan,
yeah.
right? I mean, I don't know how the Coppola family worked, but I mean, was it a tight unit? I mean, were you around? Was everyone eating dinner together at times during holidays and things?
Holidays.
Right.
Because my uncle Francis, he lives up in,
the
Napa
area.
Valley
right,
area.
Yeah.
So see him growing up more during holidays, Thanksgiving,
yeah.
mostly.
And was that the congregating place? Was Francis's place?
It seemed to be.
Yeah.
Growing up, but great, great memories, and but not a lot of like movie talk.
No.
My experience of growing up was just a very boisterous family,
yeah.
and you know, kitchen,
yeah.
a lot of cooking and singing.
Yeah.
It seems that my mom and her two brothers, one has passed away, the level of musical knowledge is pretty incredible. Like,
yeah.
My uncle Augie, who passed away, his seemed to be very classical.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think my uncle Francie do, but my uncle Francie and my mom have a real musical theater thing.
Oh yeah!
Like if you say like I love this cup, he loves this cup. Like they yeah. seem to know like a song about every like from a musical about everything. Like
yeah,
this
yeah.
microphone, he talks into it.
yeah, yeah.
And it's like encyclopedic and amazing. But so I think I grew up with more around that, like
right,
a kind
right.
of boisterous, but never like espresso and a deep conversation about like movies? A camera angle.
Yeah.
I don't have that. And
he could do it though.
I guess, the thing is that my uncle and my mom, it's in terms of them specifically, they although they're associated with Hollywood, they're very like not into Hollywood. I mean, yeah. He lives up there, first of all, but my mom is like not into Hollywood culture, and she loves movies. And if anything, growing up, I think that's what I saw was just like, wow, my mom loves movies so much more than other parents.
Right.
More like that. Like I'd come home from school and you could hear like echoing in my house, like a TV on. And I'm like, down in that room watching that. You go in there and old movies.
Yeah.
And so I think I saw like someone who loved stuff so much. But for me, music was the best. And of course, MTV.
Yeah.
And I felt that music you could do at home.
Yeah.
And movies, they seem like so big.
Yeah.
And I didn't grow up like on movie sets or anything.
You didn't go?
No. She didn't want anyone there.
Who, your mom?
Yeah.
How's she doing?
Good. She's the best. I saw her last night.
About the grandkid. Well, I mean, you got a new grandkid.
She just called me.
You got a new grandkid.
Yeah, she's so excited.
She's got to be
She loves it. Yeah. She loves it because she grew up with boys.
Yeah.
Two brothers and sons.
Yeah.
And so to have daughters, she's just like in heaven.
She's going crazy.
Oh, my God. She loves it.
Yeah.
Tap dancing and Esther Williams.
Really?
Yeah.
She goes way back. Best. In the pool?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Her, my mom's goes way. Her knowledge of, any. I feel like her knowledge of most things ends at like 1972, movie-wise.
Mm-hmm. So you grew up in Hollywood, and I guess, when was it, what was the first movie that you did? Rushmore?
Yeah.
But when growing, like it's always sort of fascinating to me that, yeah, I mean, you're younger than me, but there's always these generations of kids who are actors and, you know, you all seem to know each other because you kind of do. And it's just like any other town where people grow up. But who were your peers growing up? Were they actors or were they, you know, where'd you go to high school?
A school called Windward High School.
Yeah.
In Culver City. Who are my peers? Like, did I know any actors growing up?
When you were growing up, yeah. I mean, were there guys doing the same things, creative people that you were, that, you know, you kept in touch with the whole time?
The only one that I know, I didn't, like, because I wasn't in, like, an acting circuit, but my best friend in high school, one of my best friends in high school, there was a little group of us, Jake Gyllenhaal was his best friend growing up since they were like four.
Right.
So I knew Jake.
Right.
Since I was 12.
Yeah.
Not much has changed.
Yeah.
He's always like the handsomest, biggest guy.
Yeah.
I was like, oh man, that guy's got it.
Yeah. You're still friends?
Yeah. I am still friends with him. Haven't seen him in a while, but you know, I feel like it, you know, I remember going to dances, sitting on the wall.
Yeah.
Looking at him just dancing with like eight girls.
Yeah, right.
Going, that holy guy. Shit. How does he do that?
Yeah, it's just natural.
Fuck,
for
how
that
do
guy.
I? Where do I be? How do I begin? Yeah. Where do I start? Yeah. So much is different about us.
Yeah, you were awkward.
I felt awkward for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I was awkward. I mean, I don't. I think everyone's awkward.
Yeah, in high school,
but
junior high,
the worst.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I felt that my school, I didn't go to a big enough school where they were like, to your left, you will find the people that are the misfits.
Yeah.
Slightly over to the right, those are the jocks.
Yeah.
It was a small enough school where, you know, it was like eight-man football. It was a smaller thing.
Right.
And like
we
just got...
Everyone knew each other.
Everyone knew each other, but within that, they were like micro, you know, there's like micro...
A micro clique of three.
Sure. Yeah. And like...
yeah.
But I was... I liked sports and I liked music, and but definitely, I think I felt I was definitely not doing well with girls specifically.
Well, yeah,
that was so.
What do you attribute that to?
Them. Yeah, yeah.
So like acting really wasn't on your radar until after high school. I mean, what compelled you?
Well, what happened was that so I was in my band, and my band was like
good.
Well, that was what I was trying to do. I mean,
was
that
it
was
popular?
What I
you
was
popular
in LA. I mean, yeah, for sure. In LA, we would play. We didn't really tour much because we were
kids,
15 and 16 and stuff. But play in the LA area and sometimes San Francisco and San Diego. But yeah, we would play and lots of people would come and it was the best. And then we got signed and trying to make records. And
who signed you?
Geffen.
Yeah.
Yeah, Geffen Records before it folded.
And how did that happen?
We got our demo tape to this guy Luke Wood, who worked at Geffen at the time, and we had made a demo, and he came and checked it out, and we got signed. Yeah.
And how many did you do?
Wild records.
Yeah.
Well, we did two on Geffen, and then we moved over to Epic, Sony, and then we did a few more there. And I left.
Did you jam
with them?
Yeah.
No.
With anybody?
No.
You're solo.
Yeah. That's not my code. Like that. I'm sorry. You guys want to jam? No. You don't know about me. I'm a lone wolf.
Yeah. Just me and my gear.
Sorry. You're talking to the wrong guy. You're talking to the wrong gunslinger. You know. I just. What am I going to do? Where am I going to go? How am I going
to
do it?
But I want to too. Like, and I'm not. I don't play the kind of music you play. I'm just sort of a dirty guitar player.
Yeah.
But I wish
I could do that. I wish I could solo and stuff and play dirt. No, I can't solo. I play chords.
Yeah, I know. But do you know a lot of good chords? You know, like all the good minor Beatles chords and things.
You know them too. You just got to move the fingers around a little.
I just got to learn them.
Yeah, you learn that. I'll learn that a solo, and then we could.
I could show you some licks. You show me some chords.
I wish.
But you can just get a place. I mean, I've been beating myself up about it. And I know guys that play. I'm like, why don't we just do a weekend thing and go to a place and just play? But then that becomes its own thing. And then you have arguments and you got to decide what songs. And
truly.
Then you always end up too loud. And then it just becomes this horrible blues jam for an hour.
You know, one guy goes to the bathroom and someone else is like sitting on his amp.
Yeah, yeah.
Rolls down the volume, stops the buzzing. It's just like.
Yeah, that's it.
It's so sad. Get a gumball from a gumball machine.
That's part of it. Yeah. That's part of the rock and roll experience.
I always think the gumball machine is the worst, but the best.
Do you know Adam Goldberg?
Yeah.
Why don't you guys get together in the middle of the night and play some shit?
Who else do I got? I don't know who I got to work. I got to...
But he does the same thing you do in a way. He, you know, he's up all night sitting alone in his house.
Well, first of all, I got to change the up all night thing, and I think I've been doing a pretty good job about it. Once you got two, it's like, you know, there's no... I can't...
No time.
No.
If they're awake.
If they're awake and at night, it's you know, I got to get rest.
Yeah.
Got to be rested because I got to, you know, there's two of us and it wasn't like I was off the hook the first time. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But I was, I definitely could push my body a little bit harder. But I think also, you know, it's interesting to me, like people's creative habits.
Yeah.
And I don't know how... much I can you can just be at the whim of your own. Like I think with two kids you gotta change your body around,
and also you gotta schedule a little bit.
Sure.
You can't be as impulsive.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing, is I don't like the impulsive thing. I like the regularity of doing 3 hours a night. I have all these weird rules: 3 hours a night, and then the next day never listen to what you did, always do a new song. And then at the end of 4 months, I put everything into iTunes, and then I make playlists, and I walk around and listen to them.
To what you did.
Mm-hmm. And that's funny, because you'll notice weird things, like, oh, for those 2 weeks, everything was in A minor.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was I thinking? You know what I mean? Or you start to see what you were kind of writing, want the same thing.
Yeah.
So that's kind of fun.
The thing is also, it's rewarding in a way that, you know, if you just put it on... You've created something that exists outside of you.
It's true.
Which is different than acting. You got to wait a year.
It's true.
Very immediately satisfying.
That's the thing about it is, last year I was trying to write something and sat down. I was sitting there for days and it's a way more complicated and hard feeling, because music, even if it's terrible, as you say, you can hit it.
Yeah.
And play it for someone, even if it's bad. It's sound.
It's right there.
But a longer format type thing, especially reading, which just takes longer anyway for anyone. Music is so fast.
Yeah.
But it's harder to communicate. It's much more frustrating.
It's easier to second guess.
I admire someone who spends 8 years writing a novel.
It's crazy.
Unbelievable to me.
It's crazy.
Unbelievable.
And also, there's so much more room for insecurity when you're writing. You're like, no, I'm gonna. That's terrible.
I know. And I think much more room for totally losing perspective.
Oh, yeah.
Because with music, you can be listening to something, your ears can get burned out. But I feel like you can reset it pretty quickly, and you can also play it for people.
Right.
But if you've written like 400 pages or something, how do you ask someone to,
what a chore. Have to be pretty close to that person.
I admire that and
what the actual
fine art so much.
You admire the ability for someone to say, here's 400 pages.
Well, first of all, I admire anyone who can just read 400 pages.
I know.
I can't read very well. I'm so slow.
Fine arts too?
Well, anyone who can like draw something. It's
or paint.
Ugh. Yeah. Amazing.
Paintings, it's mind-blowing. How do you know when something's done?
I don't know. Did you ever see the movie The Mystery of Picasso?
No.
Watch this movie.
Documentary?
Yeah, it's him painting. Showing him painting.
In the black and white where
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah, I've seen bits of that.
It's get great because it's, you keep, you see, I mean, he does a painting many times and each time I'm like, that's done. And then he keeps going and makes it even better.
So how'd you get into, like, I know while we're on the music, so on the solo music, you did some stuff that was, you know, kind of got some airplay and was used in movies, and you track some stuff in some of your shows and things?
Sure, yeah, for sure. Oh,
is
yeah.
Is that part of the deal, or you just kind of throw your hat in the ring? Like, I do it?
When I did the theme song for Bored to Death.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, I feel like I said, like, let me have a whack at it, but don't, it's not.
Right, wasn't
other
a deal.
People, yeah.
Right.
But it was, that was a really fun experience.
Ames is a trip.
He's the best. Yeah. My best is my best friend.
Is he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He married my wife and I.
Did he?
Yeah. He gave a speech that was so beautiful. It was unbelievable.
Yeah, he's a
special
guy.
Yeah, he's the best.
Yeah.
But with that song, I just I kept lying in these emails saying like, yeah, I've got an idea and I've got an idea for a song, and they're like, "When can we have it by this day?" I won't have it, but I will tell you that it's got this walking bass line. Like, I kept throwing out, like, to hold you over.
Phrases.
And then it was time to write it. I had to look at all my emails and see everything I had lied about it already existing. And then it was pretty easy to write it because I had all these constraints, like walking bass line, some of these lyrics, this thing. Yeah. I was like, okay.
What happened to that show?
It got canceled the way that...
Just like that?
Yeah, it was,
It was a unique show. It was a fun show.
Who knows why these things get canceled? And I will say that I loved working at HBO. They were really cool. And if they were like, we would like to do it again, I would totally do it. And it was the best because Zach and Ted and Jonathan, it was, you know, those hours are pretty hard, but they're so much more enjoyable when you've got these guys that are just
pros
literally,
and funny.
Oh, like my face would just be hurting. And I know like after some 18-hour days, I'd go home so tired, go to bed and wake up so excited to go see those guys. Like almost like when you've got a crush on someone and it's the beginning and it doesn't matter. And
right.
Just the bet, you know, like what are they going to say today?
Yeah.
And I loved it. And it was sad. And it was also sad because Jonathan was telling me all about season 4.
Yeah.
So I had this, he had kind of had it all figured out. And then when it got canceled, there was no season 4, and then I was so confused because what do I do with this information in my brain? Yeah, you know, it's like I've been fantasizing about something. I know what's going to happen. But, you know, that I'm happy we even got the chance to do it. It's such a 1 in a million chance to, like, get the thing to go, to get the script bought, to get the pilot.
Oh,
it's like, you know.
The process is insane.
Yeah, so even that, I truly mean that. It was like, I'm so thankful we even got it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I would have loved to have had more.
How'd the acting start?
It started in a very odd way, which is that a few years before I was in my band, before Rushmore, I was making records with my band, but I also had written a play because I liked plays. And my Uncle Francis has this this estate in Napa, and he's just a fun person who decided one summer we would have creativity camp.
Yeah.
So he put out this open invitation to everyone in our family, anyone who wants to come up, paint, make short films, do plays, anything. I was so excited, and I was going into my ninth grade, and I was, yes, great. I wrote a play, and went up there, and we had like props and stuff, and I got super into it. Anyway, my cousin Sophia, she directed a play.
Yeah.
And I was in, I had like a small partner play. It was just all of us having fun.
Right.
It was the best.
Who was the audience? Just family, or did people come
people
in?
People from Napa.
Oh, they came
yeah.
at the final, how long did, was
one night.
But you were up there for a week or so, or what?
I was up there for 10 days.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doing prep?
Yeah, like prepping and directing, and it was just for fun, and it was really cool. And
now, who was involved? So Sophia directed a play.
She did one, and my uncle did one, and my cousin Christopher was in my play.
Yeah.
And my Aunt Allie made a short movie.
Now, where does Nick come into the family thing?
He wasn't there.
Yeah, he's older. Like he's
he's a little he's older than me, but that's not why he was there. I think he was probably working.
Was he around when you were a kid?
Sometimes. Not as much. I think he was really, he was really trying to make it happen. Yeah, so, you know, obviously it's hard to...
Do you have a relationship with him?
Yeah. Yeah, really. Yeah, I love him so much. And growing up, yeah, he was older than me. And it's like, that guy's your cousin. And I was like, wow, that guy? I didn't really know him at the time. I was like, fuck, this guy's the coolest.
Yeah, right.
You know what I mean? And
right.
Also his, you know, that's his boisterousness and his love for life and words, and that's my family. I mean, that's how everyone in my family kind of talks, is loud and thoughtful. And so I was like, just thought he was the coolest.
Yeah.
And anyways, but.
So you go up for the camp.
So I went up for the camp. Now, fast forward to, that was when I was 15. So when I was 17 years old, I was in the middle of making a record. I was going to my senior year of high school. And my grandfather, Carmine, who had passed away, had written a score for a movie. And my uncle, to celebrate it, was going to have the score played live in Napa. And he was inviting lots of people from San Francisco. It was a charity type event, I believe. I'm not totally sure, but I wasn't supposed to go. Anyway, my mom was going, and last minute, she's like, you got to come. It was my father's music. You got to hear my father's music and this score. So I rented a tuxedo and we went up. And at this party, there was a woman there named Davia Nelson, who was a local casting director
in
San Francisco. And because she's from San Francisco, my family's from San Francisco, she knew Roman, my cousin, and Sophia. And anyway, they were friends and they were talking. And my cousin said, what are you up to? And she said, I'm the San Francisco wing of the casting for this movie, Rushmore. And my cousin said, what's it about? And she said, it's about an eccentric 15-year-old who writes plays and is a crush on an older woman. And she said, oh, it's funny. That sounds kind of like my cousin Jason. And she said, really? And he said, yeah, he's right over there. And I had rented, I think, like a tuxedo with tails.
Yeah.
And like had a hat and a cane, maybe. It was just like a clown.
Yeah.
I was a, you know, classic type of clown person. And she invited me over. She said, come meet this is Davia. And then she walked away. And then Davia started telling me that she was casting for this movie and would I like to audition. And I said, well, I am a drummer. I'm not an actor. And she said, well, no, but Sophia said you were in her play and that you might have some things in common with this character. And I said, yeah, but... And also there's a little bit of a drummer mentality in full effect at this time, which is, are you sure you don't want to talk to the lead singer?
Yeah, right.
That was sort of my, in general, that was sort of my high school experience.
Right, right.
Was the middleman, the broker.
Yeah.
For a lot of... Right. For the other guys, for the girls.
Support.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... There was a little bit of that residue on me of, I think you might have the wrong guy.
Right.
And she said, no, I think you should audition. I said, I'm not an actor, I never auditioned. Anyways, I mean, it's silly that I would even, but I said, I live in LA. She said, well, that's where the casting office is. What's your address? We'll send you the script. This was on a weekend.
Yeah.
I got home and on Monday, this manila envelope arrived with Rushmore. It was the first script I'd ever read. And I remember reading it thinking, holy shit, like this is everything that I love. And at that time, I hadn't really seen a lot of movies that were what I was into.
Right.
It was more music that I was.
Right.
I loved movies.
So you
didn't
have
I saw a lot of weird movies.
Right.
And I had a really instrumental, my friend Brett Berg, who helps run Cine Family now, went to high school with me, and he was always bringing over like Human Highway, the Neil Young movie, or Listomania, it was fun movies since we were in eighth grade. We were watching weird movies.
Yeah.
But I had never seen like a movie that was got me like the way music did.
Right.
That kind of fuzzy feeling.
Yeah.
When I was reading the script, I was thinking, holy shit, this is like everything that I think.
Yeah.
About I really connected to it. Anyway, I called the casting person. I said, my name's Jason Schwartzman. I met Davia Nelson in San Francisco. And she goes, yes, we have you down for Friday. I said, so what do I do? I've never been to an audition. What do I wear?
Yeah.
And she said, you wear whatever makes you feel comfortable. Okay. And because I was a clown and because this was such a... It didn't feel like a goof. I didn't think of it as like, this is a joke.
Yeah.
But I definitely thought of it as, I'm not going to get this.
Right.
So what's the... You know?
Yeah.
So I decided to like get fully into the wardrobe. of the character. So I got some khaki pants. I got a blazer. My friend and I, Mike, we made a patch, Velcroed it on. I got really into
like
it.
Like a shield thing, yeah.
And anyway, I basically, my attitude was like, I'm not going to get it, but I will be remembered.
Right. How old were you?
17.
Yeah.
And I went in, and there were a couple other kids dressed up in the same kind of outfit, which was definitely a bummer. I was like, oh, fuck.
Can't even make my big
show. Guess we all know this party trick.
Yeah, yeah.
And I sat in a room with a bunch of kids, you know, and it's definitely a feeling that I did not like, which is these other kids kind of sitting there, everyone's looking at each other. I'm like, this sucks.
Yeah.
It felt like every man for himself.
Right.
Which I don't like. I don't like competition. And I'm very competitive with myself, but not, I don't like to compete. And so I felt.
Why? Do you have a feeling like there's like you're going to lose?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why exactly am I, right. Why am I even here?
Yeah. So I was like, anyway, yeah, like my wife, for instance, she loves to compete. Like she would say, like when she was little, she'd be on the way to like a soccer game and she'd just be like, I can't wait to get there and get on the field and kick their ass. And I remember being a kid, like on the way to baseball games, Dad, I think I might. Yeah, stomach infection, or you know, like trying to weasel my way out of
anything. The same way, man.
Yeah.
I envy people that have a healthy sense of competition. Yeah, because they don't beat up on themselves. You're given, like with your kids, make sure they play soccer.
Well, I'm trying to definitely, that was a big thing for me in my life was to not display that for my own children. Since they've been born, I've been trying to say yes to things that I typically would say no to.
Right.
A lot of stuff which is kind of like fear-based stuff because I guess, you know, it's just basic stuff. I don't want them to overhear me saying, I can't go to that. I'm too afraid. What if I mess up?
Right.
I don't.
Right.
You know, you think about it. I mean, in a way that I never had before.
But you were forced to play Little League?
Well, I loved it.
You did.
I loved it once it sort of started, but I didn't love being over there on the way to the game, and you get out of the car and the smell of the grass and you hear like sound of a ball hitting a mat and like a coach going, Johnny, try and hit the like not into coaches.
Yeah.
Like the whole thing was just so, even now thinking about it makes me feel terrible. But I guess I also loved it too, you know, cleats, juice boxes. There's something about it too I love.
I just didn't like have the pressure, you know, like that ball's coming.
I know.
Oh God.
I know.
What position were you?
Catcher.
Oh, so you were stationary, kind of.
Yeah.
But it was a big job.
Yeah, it sucked.
Yeah.
But
I was in center field and I just sat out there hoping like nobody hit the ball.
Yeah, I know. I know.
I didn't like batting. I don't know.
That's the thing. That's the thing I really didn't like.
You didn't like it.
No, batting.
It's a ball. You're gonna get hit by the ball.
I was like, Jesus, terrified. Am I gonna get hit? Why am I going to do this?
I know. So what were we doing? What did you like about it? The juice box?
I think that I liked, I think that I did love the camaraderie.
Right, right.
And I mean, I'm a solitary, I like lonely activities.
Yeah.
But I also love, like I love to be on a movie set because I love everyone helping each other.
Right.
So I think there was something about that looking around like, all right, third base.
Yeah.
Shortstop.
Yeah.
Second base, first base, pitcher, myself. We are the infield. I think there was something nice about that.
As long as all the pressure's not on you, I think. It's my feeling. It's like, I hope that the other guy...
No, even recently, my cousin got married and we had a family softball tournament. Like our family against their family.
Yeah.
And I had to be catcher. And a ball got hit and way out in the outfield. Someone was rounding the base. And all I was thinking was like, please let this guy beat the ball.
Yeah, get out.
Please don't even let it be an issue where the ball has to come in at the same time as this guy trying to cross the base.
What happened?
It came in right and I missed the tag. Yeah.
So the worst happened.
It happened, but it was okay. We won.
Oh, good.
We won.
All right, so you're sitting in this room with a bunch of guys in blazers.
Anyways, yeah, I go in and finally, one by one, they go in. I go in and Wes Anderson was sitting there. He's 27. And I remember instantly seeing he had Converse sandals, which I had never seen before. Started talking about those, and then this was 1997. In 1996, Pinkerton came out, and the Weezer record, and that was a huge record when it came out. Someone had like an advanced copy of Pinkerton, hearing it in a car, and I love the Blue Album, and that record blew the lid off my roof.
Yeah,
Pinkerton was it.
Yeah,
and for me and. Talking to Wes about Pinkerton for like 20 minutes.
Really?
Yeah, and it took my mind totally off the audition. And then he was like, should we read it? And I think I might have said, let's not. This was so good. It was so nice meeting you. Let's just leave it.
Good. I don't care if I get
and
the
I'll
part.
Leave.
Yeah.
And he said, no, let's read. And then anyway, we read it. And because it was my first audition, I didn't know if it was good or bad.
Yeah.
And then we started to improvise. And then he said, why don't you stick around for a little bit? I'm going to read some other people. And then he actually had me come in and be Bill Murray and audition people to play the Bill Murray's kids part.
Right.
And I went home. My mom said, how'd it go? I was like, I think it was good. I spent a few hours there. And a few hours? That's good. And but she didn't really, you know. She helped me, by the way, for that week, like learning my lines and stuff. And then,
did she give you any acting introduction?
Just she tried, you know, to like help me with stuff. But I was so, it's so overwhelming.
Did she teach?
No, but she should.
Yeah,
she's good with the teaching. She's a great teacher. Anyways, then I got a, then I guess it got narrowed down to myself and a few other people because I was unknown. I had to do a screen test.
Right.
And I did a screen test.
Yeah.
And I got the part. And it all happened pretty quickly. And they were saying, yeah, you're going to be in this movie with Bill Murray. And it just felt like a dream. And, you know, I started my senior year of high school thinking I was going to finish my record, which I did. But I did not expect to be in Houston with Bill Murray, you know, at the start of the school year.
And you grew up watching his movies. So,
yeah.
So, and he's been a pretty amazing character.
Yeah, he's the one.
Yeah.
He's the chosen one. He's the golden child. And
and you got along with him pretty well?
Yeah, I think so. And but I went back and I didn't actually think, well, now I'm an actor. I went back and I didn't have an agent or
after
anything.
You shot?
Yeah, I went back to school, kept going on my record, and that was it, you know, trying to finish the
record in school.
Yeah.
And then like what? Then?
And it happened, and it basically happened that I finished my record and then Rushmore and my album came out within a few months of each other.
Yeah.
And it was a little frustrating at the time because any press would say, an actor with a band. And I was thinking, isn't it the other way around?
Right.
You know, for me, I didn't care, but it was probably hard on my band. That's basically how it started. And
it was such a weird defining role. I mean, when you watch the movie, it's a weird movie.
Yeah.
There's no movie like it.
No.
And you're this guy no one's ever seen before.
Yeah.
And it's so defined in such the intensity of it.
Yeah.
But it took a while before someone said, like, let's put him in another movie?
Well, I don't fully remember how it all happened, but I just know that I didn't have an agent for a little while. And then I got an agent and started to get scripts. And it seemed like, okay, so is this, like, what is this plan now? What is the game plan?
Yeah.
You know, and I really was adamant about, I wanted to do another movie because I loved it so much. I also really wanted to make my band, like to get the album out, to go on tour. I mean, these were things that I dreamed of since I was little.
Yeah.
So I was really trying to do both. And I think arguably I did both. I mean, I toured and I was able to be in movies. And me leaving my band had nothing to do with wanting to pursue an acting career more obsessively. It was just its own timing had ended. But
Was it sad?
To leave?
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah, for sure. Because I loved the guys. I mean, I loved the guys and I loved being in a studio and making music. And I think the thing that helped make it a little bit better was knowing that, just because I'm leaving doesn't mean I'm leaving music. I'm just leaving the situation.
Right.
Where honestly, the touring thing was pretty, is not the best lifestyle for me in terms of that, you know, being on the road and a lot of time during the day leading up to just 45 minutes on a stage seemed odd, and I couldn't get into a rhythm.
Yeah.
I'm much more of a homebody, and I think I'm also more productive when I have my things around me and I'm trying to make stuff.
There's a loneliness that happens out there where you're just sort of at a shitty hotel.
Yeah.
In a part of town where nothing is.
That's the truth. You wake up, you walk out in a parking lot, you look around, where am I?
It's sad.
Yeah, and I grew up with brothers and I'm pretty good with sharing, but I think also it's just a thing of, well, whose cereal is this?
Yeah.
Can you move this? But I just wasn't into it. You know, like, who ate my cereal? And just like socks and stinkiness. And
a cereal problem.
Just like waking up wet and not knowing with what and how. One time the singer of my band told me when we were on tour, he said, I woke up this morning covered in broken glass.
Yeah.
And to me that summed up the existential conundrum of, he's like, I don't know where it came from. There's nothing else broken in the room. I don't know why I have broken glass. And I was like, this is not a good life.
Were you guys drinking?
This is not what I was intended. We would drink, yeah, for sure. For sure.
But not too crazy? You don't strike me as a drug guy.
No, I mean, I drink.
Yeah.
I love to drink, and but more like at home.
Yeah.
More alone.
Yeah, that's good. You drink alone when the kids are asleep.
More like
when you're recording.
Or yeah, I don't like to have a drink if my kids are awake. That's the truth. And but after I like have a nightcap and watch SportsCenter and do music and stuff. But I'm never a beer person.
No. What do you drink?
I like tequila, vodka, or gin, just straight.
Yeah. Nice.
I love it.
All right, so you're out of the band, you're an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but like, let's talk about Bill Murray for a second. Did you, because you had to learn on the job, right?
Yeah.
Did he help you? Did Wes help you? I mean, what, because you have a sort of defined style, which is who you are.
I couldn't have done it without Wes. He's my mentor, and he's my best friend too, and we still work together, and he definitely, it was just like great timing, because I think, you know, he really was asking me about what I thought about things and showing me movies. You
like
know, I'm
what?
17. I saw, like, I had never heard of Francois Truffaut.
Right.
And you know, it's just like that mentor comes into your life and starts showing you stuff. And
you're that young, too. So
sure,
you're very impressionable.
So impressionable. Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like someone who really comes in and is just enough older than you that they're a mentor and just
young
enough
old.
That they're
right.
Yeah, and just showing me movies and
he showed you
me
Truffaut.
Books.
He showed you Truffaut.
Yeah, Truffaut and you know, like just watching Martin Scorsese movies and all kinds of stuff, just kind of getting my mind blown, opening up a whole new world of real like cinephile stuff, like that there was a whole world of this stuff out there I really felt like, where was this?
Well, you know? It's so funny because your uncle's got to be one of the biggest cinephiles in the world.
Sure, yeah, but again,
you don't have that relationship with him, and he's your uncle.
Yeah, I mean, now we talk about stuff all the time, but it's not like, but not really even. I mean, I don't even, it's, yeah, I don't, it comes up just because he loves movies, but I don't go, hey, yay or nay, Truffaut. You know, I don't get into that stuff. But,
I saw your...
But he loves movies.
When I was in college, I went and saw his reissue or the re-edit of that Abel Gance's Napoleon with your grandfather's score.
That's the score that I was going to see in San Francisco.
I saw it played live with the movie.
That was the same thing they were doing. Yeah, amazing that you saw that.
Oh, yeah, with the triptych,
what
with
a strange,
the three screens.
Yeah, three screens.
Yeah, it was crazy.
Yeah, it was beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, I was very into
amazing.
It when I was in college.
That's so, what a weird connection. That's exactly the thing. That was 1997.
So, but that's interesting. So it took Wes, because you know, I guess when you're with your family, it's your family. But I mean, you had seen your mother's work. You had seen The Godfather.
I saw The Godfather for the first time when I was 16.
Yeah.
Not before. And I'd seen Rocky, and I loved it.
Yeah.
And I was, my mom's very shy, and it was probably weird for her. Like, you know, we'd walk around and the idea, Yo, Adrian, was such a big...
Oh, so people would do that to
her? Shout it, and she's like, oh, thank you. You know, she's very embarrassed. And I remember thinking at a young age, why is everyone saying this to her?
It's not her name.
It's not who they might have. Why are they always confusing her? And, you know, then she taught me about it a little bit. But she's a very private person. And, yeah, but I saw, like, going to my uncle's, you know, like, he showed, he showed Apocalypse Now once and to us and to our family, bunch of people, like, a new print of it or something. And we watched movies like, we watched Yellow Submarine when I was little. And this movie, A Prick Up Your Ear.
Prick Up Your Ears. Yeah,
I saw that when I was like
with
six.
Gary Oldham?
Yeah, I was like, what the fuck? And so there were definitely things like that floating around, but more older movies.
Yeah.
I'm talking specifically like these kind of 60s, 70s
sure. No, I
things.
Know. Right.
And that was like, whoa. And you know, and then you start to get into it. But
French New Wave movies.
That, yeah, for sure.
Well, that must have helped you with Huckabees.
Yeah, for sure.
That's a bizarre... Sure.
It just got me into the world of paying closer attention to those things.
Art films.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Was that the next big movie you did, Huckabees?
There were a few in the middle, but I would say that I really loved.
Right.
But that was, that would be the next bigger one.
And like Murray, did he, like, what, when
so
you
Bill
were...
Murray, yeah, he was like, so when I met him, it was very intimidating.
Yeah.
And as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And in the beginning, I think it was he was trying to get his footing, and I was probably freaked out and starstruck.
Right.
But after a while, I think that he really kind of got behind me and really helped me. And I couldn't have done it without him either, you know, and his support. And for sure, Wes. I mean, Wes did a thing where I was in Houston. I was 17. He was two doors down from me in the hotel, and every night he would have dinner with me. And we would talk about the scenes the next day. I mean, he really helped me.
He's like a very specific, like as he evolved as a director, like it's like every frame is a jewelry box or something.
Sure,
like
yeah. Yeah.
It's like you're looking at some meticulously organized.
Yeah. He has a vision, you know, totally a vision.
Yeah, completely visual in a lot of ways.
Yeah, very much.
And it's mind blowing.
Yeah,
I've never
it is.
Seen anybody construct something like that.
Nor have I. And but it's really a beautiful thing to see. And he has an emotional kind of similar thing where he has an idea for a tone that he wants to try to get. And I love him so much, and I'm glad to say that our friendship and our working relationship to this day continues to evolve. And I think it's, you know, great when you can find someone that you want to, that you can work with and that you want to work with over and over again, because I think that there's less chit chat every time.
Right.
You just get more deep or go to the work more quickly.
Right. Oh, yeah, because you have a shorthand.
And you're less embarrassed.
And there's a whole crew of those guys that come from Texas, isn't there?
Sure.
The Wilson brothers.
Yeah, Owen and Luke and Andrew. Yeah. And for sure.
Well, how many new movies have you done with them? Four? Three or four?
With Wes?
With Wes.
I don't know.
Let's see if we can figure it out. Darjeeling Limited.
Rushmore. Darjeeling Limited.
Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Fantastic Mr. Fox. Grand Budapest Hotel.
Moonrise Kingdom. Yeah.
So five.
Oh,
and
my
I did this short film, Hotel Chevalier. So
yeah.
Five and a half.
And then you worked with David O. Russell on that thing. That was
amazing.
Was it?
The best, yeah.
It's a crazy movie.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it was so fun.
I mean, I like that movie.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand like how someone decides to make a movie like that.
Yeah.
Do you?
Well, it was an amazing experience. And the thing that I always feel so deeply thankful and or just blown away to David about and for was that before that movie, there was another movie we were supposed to make.
Yeah.
Right after Rushmore, I met him. And he said, I've got a movie idea, and I want to talk to you about it. And we sat down, and it was this super in-depth movie about an ensemble movie. And it was going. I mean, it had a crew. It was a script. And there was and I was prepared to do it. And we were talking about it, meeting about it, having these meetings. And a few weeks before we started it, he called me on the phone really early in the morning. And he said, hey, I'm just going to give you the call first before I call everybody else. I'm going to say that we're not going to do this movie. I'm going to pause this movie because it just doesn't feel right, and I don't want to do something unless it feels right. I promised myself I wouldn't do it, but I promise you the next thing we do, you will be in it. I promise. I thought, okay, well, thank you. I was heartbroken because I was so ready to do this movie. And
did that movie ever get made?
No. And
what was it?
Well, maybe he'll make it one day, so I don't ever want to like
say
too much. But it involved a lot of music. I had written a lot of music for it,
mm-hmm.
Anyways, I stayed in touch with David, but I had gone on tour, and a little while had gone by, and then one day I get a call from him saying, "Where can I send you something?" And then this package came. I opened it, and there was a script. It said, I don't know if it said I Heart Huckabees. It might have just said Untitled David Russell Movie, and a little note that said, lovingly crafted for you. Love, David O. Russell. And I read it, and it was I Heart Huckabees, and it blew my mind, and thus began our venture on that together. And it was about a year of me going to his house almost every day, and we'd go on hikes together. And I would sit. He's so busy that it was hard to get like to schedule a meeting on the phone to talk about it. So I figured what I'll do is I'll just go to his house every day and I'll sit in the other room and I'll work on this movie. And if he has 10 minutes free, he can come in and we can talk about it and he can go back and I'll just be there. And that's what I did.
He was okay with that?
Yeah, he loved it. Yeah. And so it was great for me. I would just go to his house and I'd set up like in this like den TV room.
Yeah.
My script and notes and I would make questions, and then if David is like, I got 45 minutes, want to go for a walk? We just go for a walk, and I'd kind of go over what I was thinking about, and that was how it evolved. It was amazing. And to this day, I kind of like the idea. I just like being close to the project.
Yeah, that's very close.
Yeah, it's extremely. Too close.
You become moved in with him.
But I loved it, and it was the best. I have so many great experiences from it, and you know, I met Mark Wahlberg, who is...
he's great.
He's the coolest. I mean, he's
really solid.
He's amazing.
He is.
I love him. And yeah. Isabelle Huppert, yeah. And who was amazing. And I mean, everybody was great. Naomi and Dustin.
Yeah.
Hoffman.
Yeah.
And
Lily Tomlin.
Yep, Lily Tomlin, who, as you know,
Dustin Hoffman. How was that?
And Jude Law.
Jude Law, yeah.
The best.
It's a crazy movie.
It's the best. I had such a great time, and to me, it wasn't crazy, because I guess I just knew it so deeply at that point, you know, talking to David about it. And
what were the talks about, though? I mean, like, because it's what would you call that, a farce? I mean, what is that movie?
That's what Dustin would always say. He's right. Like, hey, guys, it's a farce. Remember, it's a farce. He's like, is it? I never saw it as a farce.
Well, what did you see it as?
I saw it as... I mean, you must know what it's like when you get so hyper-focused that you don't see everything.
Right.
And those are my favorite kind of movies anyway.
It's my life.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I thought it was about this guy who was at a breaking point, who was starting to see all these coincidences, thought that it must have meant something more, and who could he go talk to? He needed guidance, and he found these existential detectives to help him sort out his life. And it made total sense to me.
Yeah.
Because we talked about it every day, and we talked about coincidence and love and disaster and being confused and lost and sharing stories with each other. And by the time we got to shooting, it was a very serious movie about a guy going to existential detectives.
For you, it was.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
And working with people like Hoffman, having, you know, like, again, even more so than Murray, that he had this guy with this kind of catalog of experience.
Yeah, nuts.
To see his process, what did you notice about it?
Well, you have all the kind of like typical young actor stuff that's really funny. Like, for instance, you know, Dustin Hoffman means a lot to me on many levels. I hadn't seen The Graduate till I was about to go do Rushmore. My mom read the script of Rushmore, and she said, I'll be right back. She went to Blockbuster, came back with three movies: Harold and Maude, The Graduate, and Dog Day Afternoon.
Yeah.
I had never seen him.
Yeah.
And my life was changed instantly.
Another mentor moment.
Seriously.
What was it about those movies?
My mom tour. Dustin Hoffman and The Graduate, I couldn't believe it.
I could see that, how that would have an impact or inform Rushmore.
Yeah, it was just, I had never seen a lead character like that.
Yeah.
And anyways.
And Dog Day Afternoon?
And Dog Day Afternoon was just insane because... To me, it was so funny.
Yeah.
He's so funny in it.
Yeah, he's so vulnerable.
Like, I know, it's just
like the last time you saw him like that. I mean,
when he's like trying to jump up and put something on the camera, and the way he, if you watch the movie, like, there's a way he goes to the, he like takes out his gun, he looks like he's holding a box of fire, so he whips it like he's crazy. I mean, it's just insane. It's like so unhinged.
And what was the other one?
Harold and Maude.
Oh, yeah, Bud Cort.
Yeah. And so I love Dustin Hoffman, and when he told me he was going to be in it, I guess, oh my God.
What about these young actor things?
One is that I got this documentary that David had that was the making of Tootsie.
Yeah.
And I saw that he was wearing a blue Lacoste shirt, and he had this binder, like a binder with a script. And I said, I'm going to wear a Lacoste shirt and have a binder too. and it's great.
Saw that in the Tootsie documentary?
Yeah, and I said, I'm going to become that.
Yeah.
That's what I'm going to be like.
Yeah.
And I remember...
For your process.
Yeah. Like, just trying to figure it out, because I'm not a trained actor, so part of it's emulation. And,
right.
And, you know, also, my father, he passed away when I was 13.
Yeah.
13, 14. And so I learned how to shave from watching The Graduate.
Right.
Because he shaves in it a lot.
Yeah.
And... So I like, I you know, that's being a fan, you put a lot on people. So
I
remember that Dustin came for this table read, and I went in the bathroom. I like locked myself in there. I couldn't come out. I was shaking. And, but these young actor things are like things like, I was so nervous. I got so into it. I was like going to, I flew out to Paramus, New Jersey. That's where the movie was originally set. And I stood outside of like a Home Depot and read poetry to see what that would feel like, because that's what the character does, and have people yell at me, and I filmed it. I put a camera on a car. Like, I did all this, like, dumb not dumb, but stuff that was, you know, I was looking for an answer.
Yeah.
And that was the way that I would help me. And I would tell Dustin stuff like this, and he'd go, really? You don't want to just do it like that? You know, it seemed like everything you'd heard about him wasn't true anymore. And I was, like, kind of embarrassed. He was so easygoing. And I remember
really?
Kind of being hurt. Like, I saw this on the iHeart Huckabee.
You've done all this method stuff.
All this crazy stuff. Yeah. On the documentary for iHeart Huckabees,
yeah.
There's this moment where Dustin's talking about every actor in the movie, and he's like, Jude is just fantastic, and Naomi, and of course Mark is a revelation, and Jason Schwartzman is so obsessive. And I remember, oh my God. Like, obsessive? What the fuck? I'm just trying to do what you were doing. I learned, you know, you taught me everything. It was a little like that. But I wasn't like emulating him, but it was, but
you were
I was.
Just looking for a method.
Yeah, I was looking for something, and he seemed to be like a good answer. Yeah.
Oh, it's so sad.
But it was really funny. It was the best, and he's so sweet, and he's so goofy, and he really is. He was such a, he taught me so many things. For instance, the first day of shooting, David O. Russell wanted to change some lines around.
Yeah.
And he told me a new line, and then I went up to Dustin. I said, Dustin, just so you know, David told me to do these new lines. I'm just telling you. So then he's like, God's okay. So later at the end of the day, my first day of work complete, I went to his trailer, and I said, Mr. Hoffman, I just want to say I'm want to say thank you for letting me mess around out there and try those different things. And he said, are you kidding me? A take is the one place in life you can fail.
Yeah.
And it was so sweet.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was, you know what I mean? It was just, he's saying, don't worry about it. Just let it rip. And he just, you know, he was so free. And he loves trying things.
Yeah.
And every take, he's messing around. And he's really trying to help everyone. And I remember there's one scene in the movie where he says to me, he like asks me if I want something. He's like, do you want this? Is this what you want with your life? And I said, yeah. I couldn't get it right. And then, but earlier that day, he'd walked in wearing a really cool button-up shirt.
Yeah.
And then we were doing these takes, and it was my close-up. And then he said, do you understand what I'm saying? I'm, yes. Do you really understand? Yes. And he held out a shirt. He took out a shirt from behind his back. He said, do you want this shirt? I said, yeah. And he said, then come get it. And I walked off. But they used the take of me saying, yeah, about the shirt.
Oh, really?
For like me. So that kind of stuff. Like, he's very helpful.
Oh, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
So your father passed away when you were young.
Yeah.
And he was in movies?
No, he was a entertainment lawyer and then a movie producer.
But you have good memories. You weren't so young.
For sure. No, yeah. Memories are a tricky thing. I don't seem to have, I don't know really what people's memories are like. My memories don't seem to be as, they're vague and then some are super detailed.
Yeah.
Like I can remember what a pattern on a shirt was.
Right.
But in one memory, and then I have no recollection of something else.
Of, like, bigger memories.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
I wonder how that was loaded up emotionally in your head.
Just, in general, it seems to be that way.
With everything.
Still, yeah.
Like, there could be huge events that are just gone, but you remember some shoes.
Yeah, like, I'll remember, like what the layout of a room and where the bathroom was and where the exit sign was. Like, I can remember like weird things like that sometimes.
Yeah.
But then I can't remember like someone's like, yeah, we met. Remember we talked all about this? Yeah. And I'm like, no, I don't remember that.
I don't remember you at all.
Yeah. So I don't know what that attributes to, but.
I have that too. So I watched the new movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think we could probably talk forever. I thought it was great.
Thanks.
It was kind of an abrasively.
Yeah. Abrasive is the word.
But charming somehow.
Mm.
I think that you have a natural amount of charm that's going to carry even the biggest asshole through an entire film.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And but it was fun to play. I mean, this character was a guy who definitely never has a moment where Philip is in Listen Up, Philip. He's a pretty abrasive, relentlessly mean person at times, and but he never like has a moment where he like tries to be nice or tries to like say just kidding, which honestly, like I think I've done that in the past where it's just the way things work out. It's like there is a redeeming moment or an attempt at a redeeming moment, and I like this because there wasn't.
He's very unsympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
And hard to like. It's a weird little movie in a way. It seemed to be shot very cheaply.
Yeah, it was. Well, it's funny you say because I haven't ever done like a G.I. Joe budget movie.
Yeah.
But compared to what I've done before, this was very low budget. For this director, this was like 8 times the budget of his last movie.
And how'd you get a script like that? Why the director, what's his name?
Alex Ross Perry.
Yeah. He approached you?
No, I was sent the script through my agent, and it came with a DVD. And I was kind of taken by it, honestly, because it was so much bigger than a normal script. It was way thicker.
Yeah.
And I know it's an odd thing to have catch your attention, but, and I was kind of, I flipped through it when I first got it, and it was so descriptive. It looked almost more like a book.
Yeah.
And I thought, someone took a lot of time to write this.
Yeah.
I'd like to read it. And, but when I read it, it was, the character comes out of the gate saying some pretty harsh stuff, and he's not treating the people around him very kindly. And it kind of like rubbed up against me the wrong way. I typically, you know, I love humor that is fucked up.
Yeah.
But I typically will gravitate towards someone who is not mean to other people. He just messes up situations because he's
self-involved.
Got some problems.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like I don't gravitate to as much as like, hey, look at Fatty over there.
Yeah, yeah.
As much as like
mean-spirited
Fatty trying to not eat bad, and then he eats bad, and he's got like food all over. You know, like I like more when it comes out of there. So these characters doing that, I was like, whoa. But there was something. It was so elegantly composed. Like really, the script was so beautiful. Like he would describe everything in the room and full of all kinds of details that were really odd. Like he would say, this, you know, he walks in the room, it is filled with this. It is his birthday. But you never hear it's his birthday in the movie.
Right.
Just weird details. And this is a peculiar piece. But I definitely felt like after 30 minutes of reading it, I'm going to put this down.
Yeah.
It's too claustrophobic for me.
Yeah.
This is too much. This character has got too much venom.
Yeah.
But after 30 minutes of being away from it, I was thinking, what's going on with him? I couldn't, like, I was addicted. So I went back and I read another 30 pages. I said, oh my God, I can't believe he would do that.
Yeah.
Put this away. And that kind of went back up and back and up and back for the whole day. And at the end, I thought, man, I love this thing.
Yeah.
And I love that it never has that redeeming moment. And it has some cool stuff. Like, it's all about Philip, my character, but then all of a sudden it becomes about his girlfriend and Philip drops out of the movie. And then all of a sudden it becomes about Jonathan Pryce's character and we drop out of the movie. And that was unusual to me, like shifting the narrative. Like that. I mean, you see it sometimes, but it's rare.
He's a hell of an actor.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Like it was surprising to see him.
Oh
like, I was
God.
Like, oh, it's that guy.
Yeah. I was definitely very intimidated because I'm not trained and he's, you know,
yeah.
He just come from doing King Lear. I wasn't sure if it was like I have a car shop in a small town. I do my best, but there's no one really in this town who's going to question me.
Yeah.
You know, like, yeah, you need a new this. And they're like, okay.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, here comes, like, the guy who's, like, you know, designs cars.
Yeah.
He's coming into, like, his car broke. He's coming in and it's like, is this the guy that's going to, like, call bullshit? But yeah, he's amazing. And to watch him work. And also, you know, he was in G.I. Joe. And our budget was smaller. And I was thinking, how's this going to be for him? There's no trailers.
Yeah.
There's no comforts.
Well, they like to act.
They like to act. That was what I was going to say. Yeah, he likes to act, and it was a real lesson in always being agile.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't need anything.
Yeah.
He doesn't need any fancy food or anything special, and I think the less you need and the more quickly you can go to work and just pick up and leave.
Yeah.
Seems maybe the better. I mean, that was what I learned from him.
How long was the shoot?
25 days.
Yeah, so he's in and out.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I liked the movie, and there was like interest. Like, it had sort of a Huckabee's kind of tension to it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. It's tense, and we play this. The whole movie is sort of about these people in the worst part of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of always the idea was, let's just show 9 months in a terrible time for these people. And I think that was freed it up to not have a cathartic moment at the end.
Right.
And, you know, it's in the spirit of those types of movies where the person at the end really isn't all that different from the person at the beginning. And like Alex was talking about, like American Gigolo, like that movie opens with a guy driving, you know, in his convertible, and it ends with him in jail. And in a way, it's a similar thing of a guy, like he doesn't, like we're not condoning the behavior.
Right.
Because he doesn't end up, I mean, if he had a cathartic great moment and everything, he learned something at the end, it'd be like, well, then it's okay to be this way. But
right.
really, the girls are the only ones that get out alive.
Yeah, that's right.
You know,
right.
like the guys end up really screwed up. And it was a real, there was something so nice about doing that. And also playing, like, I don't confront people really in my life. I never had to do it. I think that I always got away with humor, which led into a passive-aggressive
right.
type thing with people. With my family, I could say, like, that's bullshit.
Right.
But this character says exactly what he's thinking all the time, and that is not really me.
Right.
And it was fun to do it.
All right, so, all right, before you go here, I was over at Amazon yesterday pitching, and I told them I was talking to you today, and
yeah.
they're like, why isn't he going to be here today? Or something like, yeah. you know, you're going to talk to him?
Yeah.
You're doing a thing with them?
Yeah.
How many have you shot?
Executive producing and writing a few of a TV show called Mozart in the Jungle. And we have 10. That's including the pilot. So we're shooting 9. And next week we start the final one.
And you're a podcaster.
Well, I play a part. It's all about classical music in New York and the scene. And different levels of it, and the high and the low, and trying to get into it, and stuff. And I play Malcolm McDowell plays this guy named Thomas Pembridge, who's the former maestro superconductor of the New York Symphony, as we mm-hmm. call it. But he's now on the way out. But he's there as this kind of like a leftover king or something. He's not really sure what his job is. And in my scene with him, he's excited that he's getting an interview. And he's putting on makeup and all this stuff. And I walk in and he's saying, so we can put the cameras over here. I was thinking we'd set up the cameras here. The BBC did it like this. And I think the light's very good. And I'm saying, oh, there's no cameras. He says, excuse me? I said, this is a podcast.
Yeah.
And, oh, wonderful. That's what he says. And thrilling.
Yeah.
And I sit down. I have a podcast called B Sharp.
Yeah.
And because that's a note that doesn't exist, and my name is Bradford Sharp.
Yeah.
And I'm a very quiet-talking classical music
uh-huh.
podcaster.
Yeah.
Who's really, like, you know, I wanted to be kind of cool and stuff. He wears a leather vest. And it was really fun. It was amazing to work opposite Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah, you're getting a couple of good English
guys. We wrote this scene where it's an interview, but he said, can you just interview me for real? Just let the cameras roll. And I talked to him for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And he answered all these questions as this character. It was amazing.
Wow.
It was a thrilling moment. I mean, I was like, has he really conducted? It seemed like he had really conducted. I was like, tell me about conducting Mozart. Oh, my God. It's the best. I mean, you know, of course, you're in touch with God. I was like, it was amazing. So, yeah, it was really cool. And
well, that sounds fun.
Yeah, it's been hard, but fun.
What's your relationship with New York?
I don't live there.
I know.
I live in L.A., but my relationship with it is, I've never lived there, as a matter of fact.
But I hear it in your music, too, a little bit.
About New York?
Yeah, something about it.
Well, I love it. Both my parents were from there. My dad was from Brooklyn, and my mom was from Long Island.
Yeah.
It's still, because I've never lived there, it's when I'm there, it's everything is beautiful to me.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah. I'm like, oh, look at these buildings, and look at that. And
the pace.
And so I'm definitely like...
it's a romantic idea.
It's still romantic to me, even when it's not romantic. Because
for
Bored to Death, you know, we'd be there for 4 or 5 months.
Right.
And, you know, at the fourth month, I'm like, oh, I could go home now. But it's still amazing to me. And
There's nothing like it. That
really
when you get
not.
Within the city and you're like, holy shit.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. And the community of people that seems to be there, it's really good. But it's funny because I have such a positive thing. Alex, the director of our movie, it's funny because he was saying to me, he's like, yeah, New York, you know, I want to show it's like cutthroat and it's claustrophobic and people walk slowly and you feel like shit and you want to get out and it's loud and, you know, people will take you down if they can. And I love it and I'll never live anywhere else. And I was like, wow, okay. Yeah, you know, so that's how he sort of feels about it and sees it. And, I love it there, but I love Los Angeles because I'm from here, and I think there's I don't know. I just cheesy stuff. Like, I like the light and the way it feels when it starts to set, and I like the space. And
yeah, it's cooling down a little.
Yeah, I love it.
So what do you do today? What's going on now?
Today, I'm going to go do a few lines for Mozart in the Jungle, some ADR lines.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to Chicago.
Today you're going?
Yeah.
Oh, well, have fun. It's a great city.
Yeah, it's the best.
Good talking to you,
man. I love Chicago. It's this great. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's fun, man.
You're a great one.
I appreciate it. All right, see, he was a nice guy. What a pleasant conversation. I love that guy. So what do I got to tell you? Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get that app. Why not? 500-plus episodes, 550-something. I don't even know anymore. You get the free app, and you get the most recent 50, always free, and then you upgrade and you can stream all of them. What else? Did you enjoy the show? The music you hear on this show, the theme song, was created by John Montagna, and the new music that you hear on today's show is by a guy named DJ Copley. And then there's my noodling at the end. But I just, you know, thanks for listening. I'm going to be at work all day doing my thing. I don't even know what a compressor does. Do you? Let me see. Hit it. I don't know. Do you hear any difference? We know what the phaser does. Boomer lives!